You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Craig Davidson is a leading literary author. As Nick Cutter, he writes the best horror that you can possibly have the opportunity to read. His books, As Nick Cutter, are The Troop, The Deep, The Acolyte, Little Heaven, The Breach. It's an audio-only book. And with Andrew F. Sullivan, he wrote The Handyman Method. His new novel is The Queen. Thank you for joining me, Nick.
Oh, Rick, thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Before we go any further, I do want to mention that this book does include the contemplation of suicide. And as such, I want to remind our listeners that you can call 988. It's a suicide prevention line. And that said, congratulations, Nick. You have topped yourself, and that is a significant feat. After, you know, I read your first book as Nick Cutter, The Troop. Is that still being, I know it was optioned by James Wan. Is it still in production?
It's still with them. Let's say that there's been some there, as I'm sure, as you know, from talking to many writers, you know, that stuff kind of moves and fits and starts if it moves at all. So they still have it as one of their, you know, one of their projects, but, as like, there's nothing solid to say about it, but yeah, they've had it for quite some time. It'd be lovely to see if they could do something with it, 'cause I love James Wan and, their whole group.
Well, okay, that said, this book, in the kind of introduction, you mentioned that one of the inspirations for this book was a book called 13 Reasons Why. This is a book that was recently made into a movie on Netflix. It contemplates teen suicide. Could you explain, you know, how you took that subject in as a writer of extreme horror?
Well, you know, what I liked about that book specifically, and you're right, it did certainly come under a great deal of scrutiny, I think, with school boards, parents, as you're right, the concern is that it was glorifying suicide, or using it as a way sort of to exact revenge, I think. So for me, what fascinated me about it was the way that, just on a narrative level, you mentioned The Troop, and with The Troop, I was really influenced by Carrie. I mean, I'm influenced by Carrie with this book as well, but I really liked how Stephen King, with that book, used sort of the interstitial idea of newspaper reports and magazine excerpts and all sorts of sort of extraneous material to the plot itself to move the main plot of Carrie along, you know, sort of giving readers things that would not be available within the main plot, on that they would, you know, sort of had accumulated after the main events of the novel had taken place. And so with this one, I read years ago, read 13 Reasons Why. And I mean, honestly, what stuck with me most was just the narrative chassis, which was audio tapes becoming this kind of narrative propulsion. The main character, who is no longer even in the, she never shows up because she's obviously passed away, you know, has left these tapes for the characters to sort of follow. And I thought, what a clever method of moving the plot forward. So that was probably my main takeaway in terms of how that book influenced me, is just that narrative chassis, which I changed slightly by using a cell phone, which obviously offers you quite a bit more sort of narrative flexibility than a Walkman does with the tapes. And also, it was set in 2018, so any teenager going around with a Walkman would be one of those almost performatively archaic type people who purposely listens to things and does things that are kind of old fashioned on purpose. And that was not the part of my aesthetic. So yeah, I used less so the sort of suicidal ideations that Hannah Baker in that book, that's sort of, there's certain elements of that probably in The Queen, but mainly what I was really interested was that narrative chassis of using a phone to sort of create a scavenger hunt idea for the book.
You know, one of the things that struck me is that the teenage years are naturally years of body horror, because your body, I mean, between the ages of 12 and 20, your body undergoes unimaginable changes, much like, you know, and this is also pertinent to this novel, like an insect going into a cocoon and, you know, a squirmy little caterpillar goes in and what comes out is a nasty damn wasp.
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, in terms of writers writing about their teenage years, you know, most of us do have to go back, because by the time we've accumulated the skills or the instinct or the desire, quite frankly, to be a writer, there's only a few of us, the S.C. Hintons of the world, who you know, are writing about being a teenager while they're still actively a teenager. But for the rest of us, it's and sometimes, you know, our children are good barometers. Obviously, you get to see them go through. I have a 12-year-old who is, again, on the cusp of that kind of hormonal craziness that you've mentioned. And you can see harbingers already, you know, a moodiness, unwillingness to get out of bed. You know, anything that I say to him suddenly is met with kind of apathy, or like things that used, you know, dad jokes that weren't called dad jokes. They were just called jokes. And now they're, you know, that's real funny, dad. So, you know, you can sort of see your own children, as I know my parents and your parents could, watch us move into our teenage years with a certain amount of concern. And yet, as you said, you can't do anything about it. It's simply a stage of life that we all go through. And it is like this. There's probably no other time that we are as emotionally or physically changed as during that time. So, yeah. And it, you know, for me, it was a lot of fun to go back and try and write from that perspective. As you mentioned in The Troop, I was writing sort of from a preteen perspective, but I don't think I've ever written. I had one section of a book I wrote under my own name called Cataract City, which captured, you know, the characters in their teenage years. But other than that, I haven't done, and I certainly haven't written from the perspective of a teenage girl, which was a challenge.
And that would be my next question. Research, not fun, I would imagine.
Also rather perplexing. How do you do it, right?
Right.
I don't have a daughter. I do, but she's 4 years old. So she's well away from the point in time when the characters in this book are. And obviously I feel, you know, I think it's, Rick, it's like, you know, there's certain landmines with every book, and some of them, you know, going in. And I really would be lying if I said that when this idea came to me, sort of some of the elements of its conception and recognizing it would need to be a younger cast of characters, that I didn't try to jury-rig it somehow that it would be potentially a male, a boy narrator, because I would feel on firmer ground. But in all the peregrinations and sort of trying to unfold it and twist it and turn it over, it just wouldn't work that way. So it's sort of, I sort of felt shoehorned into needing to try this. And I think what I tried to do, I mean, first of all, I did things like, I mean, I live here in Toronto, and the book is set in, you know, kind of my spiritual hometown of St. Catharines, which is about 2 hours south here. And so you just go home, you know, you go back there and you go to your old high school and you walk around. And it's amazing, sort of in the Proustian way of like the smell of the school brings you back in a way to that time. You know, the paint on the lockers, there's all sorts of stuff that helped anchor me a little bit closer. And then I dragged out my old yearbooks and went through those. And my old high school actually has a Facebook page, and we had a very lively AV club at the time. And so there's a lot of old video footage, which, you know, makes me feel very old, but also was helpful in sort of, again, I don't know, connecting me a little closer to that time in my life. None of that helped me perspectivize things through a female narrator. And that, for that, I just tried to stick as well as I could to things that I felt to be universal. you know, feelings that and experiences that aren't necessarily male or female. But one of the big things in this book, as you've read it, is that time in our lives where the summer before college, you know, where some people are going away, some people are staying in their hometown. And it these people who've known each other for their lives, their whole lives, like I did, you suddenly reach this schism, this point in the road where your ways part. And, you know, 5 years later, you run into a dear friend, you know, from high school or elementary school on the street, and you realize, like, I don't know this person at all anymore. And you're sort of shocked by how quickly that distance is settled between you. So to me, that feels like something you might have experienced, I might have experienced, but also on both sides of the gender divide, you would have experienced something similar to that. So if I could stay within that sort of area of play, where it felt like things were universally accepted as experiences as from humans, then I felt on at least semi-safe ground.
Well, I'll say that from my perspective, I thought you did a really good job of finding that both that universal feeling and the female perspective. And one of the things that struck me when you were talking about going back to high school, it must have seemed just a little bit creepy to you, both seeing it as an adult and remembering your time there as a kid, but seeing it as an adult, you just go, wow, this is like so small.
Well, yeah, your perspective is so, you know, I didn't come from a small town. I came from, I guess, a medium-sized, I came from a city, but like I live in Toronto now, like a big city, and St. Catharines is probably 150,000. When I was there, maybe 124,000. So, and I guess the closeness to Toronto made it feel like, for a lot of us, that like cool things were happening in this world, but they weren't happening where we were. They were happening somewhere else. And probably you as well, Rick, or a lot of us, like, you know, you leave your town potentially and you go and you explore other places. And for me anyways, the resonance comes is like, it's not necessarily the big things are happening elsewhere. The big things are happening, you know, that kind of notion that there is this great giant world out there that is all the things that are happening there are not happening in your own hometown. That doesn't actually hold water with me. I felt like all the great big emotions that I felt outside of my hometown, I also felt in my hometown. And some of the great connections that I made outside of my hometown, well, I also had those in my hometown. And when I go home, because my parents still live there and my brother still lives there, and we go home with the family, it actually feels very much like home. We go down the highway and we're getting into the city limits, and I inevitably feel like sort of an unlocking in my chest and a certain feeling of coming home. So it's amazing that, you know, you go and you live a bunch of different places and you have a bunch of different experiences, but ultimately you feel that the place you're leaving, yeah, was very small and very provincial and it was lacking. And then you come back and you realize, no, it feels like it has everything that I always needed.
And too, what you said was that you have this feeling that big things are happening at home or outside of your home. But what's really happening, I think that's very important to us, and we don't realize this until long after, is what's happening inside of you. The changes you're making, the changes that, you know, you feel about your friends, the decisions they've made, and comparing them to the decisions you're made or able to make. And I think that's one of the things this book does really, really well. On one hand, it is buried hip deep in things that we can't talk about and we prefer to never experience.
Right.
And from the get-go. That said, I think that what really makes all this work, makes us willing to wade through the goo, as it were, are the narrative connections, the story that you have to tell. There are two stories that kind of intertwine, mm-hmm. but the story of the people in high school and the way they feel, and your main character, Margaret, and our, you know, her friends, I think that that's the power that pulls us through. And when things become monstrous, then, you know, people do become monsters. We've seen that happen to us, and it doesn't require any great, you know, any of the terrifying and wonderfully described special effects that you create on the printed page. Right. I mean, it happens in their brains. body horror may come from this idea that things are going to spout out at you or whatever, but it starts in the brain because the brain's a very important part of our bodies.
Yeah. Well, and like, as you said, not only is teenagehood a time of dynamic bodily change and mental change, but it's also, my wife works at Sick Kids Hospital, and so she works often with teenagers. And, you know, it's not, you're not emotionally evolved at that point, frankly. I mean, there's all sorts of studies that would say that you are not, you know, your empathy level is not up to the point that it will be when you, you know, hit your 20s and 30s, for most of us anyways. You know, some people never empathetically evolve, but most of us do. And so for me, you know, when I think back to my teenager years, yeah, okay, there's a lot of great memories, but there is also probably more shame attached with that time in my life of some of the things that I did and some of the things that I was involved in. And also, you know, things were done to me, of course. It wasn't, you know, like, you know, I think most of us in the teenage years, we are, you know, there are those golden few who are probably the oppressors always, if they want to be that, you know what I mean? Or they float above everything and maybe nothing touches them. And then there are the few who are, you know, sort of like just constantly predated upon, and that's terrible. But most of us are in the meaty part of the curve where sometimes we are predated upon, and sometimes because we're predated upon, it makes us feel like, well, we don't want that to happen. And so you pass it down, you know, and the cruelty sort of becomes implicit to that time in their lives. And I think that was a big part of the book, is that I think the main character Margaret feels a great degree of guilt for some of the things that she's done, and reckoning with the fact that she's not going to have a chance to particularly absolve herself of it, because the person who, you know, who she feels the most responsible to is no longer there to sort of allow her to, you know, make good, essentially. But I mean, I have experiences like that as well, and I know there are people out there who have, having done things to me, probably feel like, oh, you know what I mean? I wish I hadn't done that to Craig. And certainly I feel, you know, from that time in my life, more so than any, I wish I hadn't have done. So it is kind of a weirdly cruel time in our lives. But again, we're not quite the people that we're supposed to be yet, or we're not yet the people that we will eventually turn into. And so it's probably reasonable and natural that we feel a level of angst about, you know, sort of some of the things that we did back then. And I wanted to explore that in the book too, obviously, that time in our lives as best as we could. And, you know, from the good and the bad perspective.
Well, I think you do a masterful job of creating that, you know, that kind of golden hours feeling of the just before you graduate and you know, thinking back where you're as a teenager, you're kind of thinking back, well, I did this thing good and I did this thing bad and I was a geek here and oh my God, I'm so ashamed of myself. And well, now I'm getting out of here. So it's a very confusing time. And at the same time, you know, some of us are like, you know, have, you know, look perfect and some of us look awful.
You don't want to peak in high school, as people say, you know, like I remember one of the stories, the coolest guy in high school, you know, I don't need to say his name or anything like that, but he was a genuinely nice guy too. He wasn't a jerk or anything, but he just felt like the most fortune shined upon him. You know, if everyone else was the clouds, he would have the single ray of sunlight that would sort of like just halo him around. And then it was like my third year of university, I was going to go back to university and my parents and I went to Denny's. And you know, at Denny's there's the little pass where the short order cooks put the food up. And I swear that his face appeared at that pass. And I was like, no. You know, it's not that, hey, again, it's not like, being a short order cook at Denny is nothing to be ashamed of, absolutely at all. But you would expected like the coolest guy in your high school was about the last place I expected to see his face pop up. You know what I mean? And that he had made my, you know, Eggs Benedict was sort of blew my mind, you know? So, you know, again, and I've known him since. My brother actually became really good friends with him, and he's actually doing very fine and super happy with his life. But it's, I guess it goes to show is that if there's a point in your life when you don't want to, you know, you sort of don't want to be the high school hero, obviously, but there are those. And there are those who feel like, you know, high school is just the start of this upwards trajectory, which seems to show no limits. And you just don't, it's kind of annoying sometimes. It's like, you know, you get these people who feel like they don't know struggle. But then again, that's, you know, that's perceptive. You're basing that on your own sort of cloistered understanding of them.
Now, the other plot thread also, it has to do with a very young child.
Yes.
Rudyard. I love the name Rudyard. I was and remain to this day a fan of Rudyard Kipling's poetry and fiction. When I was just, oh God, 3 or 4 years old, I was an early reader and reading the Jungle Book and listening to the Jungle Book as narrated by Basil Rathbone on a record.
Sherlock Holmes.
Later. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, talk about creating this other plot thread and also the fire ants that you describe so well. How much is real and how much of it is not? That's one of the joys of this book is when we're reading through some of the slightly speculative parts, you got to think, wait, some of this is real.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a great question. You know, I felt like with Rudyard, initially, and you can probably see strains of him, he was an Elon Musk kind of built on that kind of framework, and I still there, but there was a time. I mean, okay, so the first thing is one of the hardest things with this book initially was why would he, again without spoiling it, why would he embark on the absurd objective that he ultimately embarked on? And you will remember a time, Rick, pre-pandemic, when Jeff Bezos and Elon were fighting which could be the billionaire to make it into space first, you know, and they were very passionate about this. And Bezos, I think, got William Shatner into space and said, that's good enough. You can take it from here, Elon. And he has. And I think, you know, with his idea of trying to, you know, sort of move humanity off planet at some point, I thought, well, what if he required a sort of worker that was not susceptible to sort of the predations of like accelerated gravity or punishing gravity or a methane environment? So how could you create a sort of a hybrid organism that could withstand, you know, sort of the pressures of a hostile planet? And so I played with that and I like, oh, well, you know, okay. But I thought, no, I think I would rather it be sort of something more personal. And quite frankly, I started thinking, what is the most absurd trauma that someone could withstand as a child, you know, that would absolutely repattern and reorient their entire outlook and put them on this course of, you know, again, this objective that makes no sane sense, obviously, and is obviously morally repugnant as well. So that started me down the line. And again, maybe you've read this too, if you've read Rudyard Kipling and the Jungle Book, potentially when you were in school, or maybe it predates you, but there is a book, a story called Lenigan versus the Ants by Carl Stevenson. And was in Esquire back in the 40s, but it since ended up getting taught in schools a lot, sort of like grade 10 English. It doesn't work anymore because it doesn't, it's culturally retrograde at this point, but just as an adventure tale, it's great fun. It's this guy trying to protect his property against these, yeah, rampaging ants, which will eat anything. And they, when they're in their trillions, you know, they really will. They'll just cut like a buzzsaw swath through a jungle or anything. I remember reading that. And then years No, I guess before that year's book, I remember reading it and thinking, this reminds me of that MacGyver episode. And there was a MacGyver episode back in the 1980s where Richard Dean Anderson protected some kind of jungle lab from, you know, from ants. And I'm like, that's very much clearly MacGyver versus the ants. So those two, and then H.G. Wells wrote about ants. And then in the 70s, after Herbert published The Rats, you might remember there was an enormous groundswell of, you know, animals rampaging through humanity, basically, you know, animals, insects, whatever it was. So there were some ant-themed books then as well. So I've just been fascinated with ants. And I thought, okay, let's put these two things together. My fascination with ants, my need for the protagonist to have a life-shattering traumatic event as a youngster. And you, Rick, I think knowing the bent of my mind with these Cutter books, you maybe not completely surprised as to where those two things went.
Now, you know, to this book, I brought my own personal experience as a child. Oh. About the same age as Rudyard, when we meet him, I was like 7 or 8, and very scientifically minded. And I said, you know, Rick, I wonder if a bee can sting you when it's dead.
You had to test that theory.
I tested that theory, and there are plenty of little honeybees, and I just kind of slapped one down until it stopped moving and I figured this is dead, and then I dropped that stinger in my arm, or no, in my hand, and let it go, and you know what? They can't sing when they're dead.
You learn something every day.
Moreover, what I learned was that I'm allergic to bee stings.
Oh, no. That's not a good...
That was not a good lesson. My entire arm was so swollen, I couldn't get out of my T-shirt for a day or two. And, you know, since then, I have, avoided bee stings. And bees.
As one would, yeah.
But I really loved, bee monsters, as it were. And as a kid, one of the earliest episodes, and it was in the first season of The Outer Limits, there was an episode called Zzz. A scientist who's studying bees finds to his misfortune that bees are studying us, and the queen bee has learned to transform itself into a human being.
Oh.
To everybody's dismay and unfortunate experience, it doesn't end well for anybody.
No, those episodes are pretty good. Yes. Well, they are, you know, bees and maybe wasps, because I think with bees we can sort of see the value in them, you know, and with wasps people often are like, why do you even exist? Why Mother Nature not abhor you, and why are you not just eliminated out of the phylum of, you know? But actually, you know, when you research it, I mean, unsurprisingly, I guess everything on Earth has a purpose, and wasps are part of that as well. As annoying as they are to us, as you know, I always think of them as the tyrants of the picnic. Like, just one showing up is enough to set everybody on edge, and you think their buddies are going to be coming shortly. So I've been stung many times by never by a bee that I can think of, but by wasps quite a bit. And I kicked an anthill when I was a kid too, thinking that would be hilarious. And until, you know, you felt they were up both trouser legs and making their way up past your belt line. And then you think, well, that's my own fault. No, but I think we all have those experiences. I know with my own two kids, you know, but there's something innately, I guess, alien about there, other than maybe the things that exist at the bottom of the ocean that we don't even know about. There's nothing in our world that feels more like they could have crashed as an entire sort of, unit from a spaceship, like from an alien spacecraft, and just and struggled out and gone about their lives than bugs. You know, they seem so antithetical in their behavior. They don't care about invading each other's space or yours. And I guess the mindlessness of them, and then the sheer volume of them as well, I think is there's all sorts of things that just send a chill up the spine of humanity.
And you just reminded me of the other Outer Limits that it's called the Zanti Alf Misfits. The Zanti contacts us through our radio telescopes and tells us they're sending some of their prisoners to our planet where they'll be safe from the Zanti, and it'll all just work out really well. But of course, Bruce Dern is mucking about in the Joshua Tree Monument Place rocks where they land and upsets them. And they are ants that are about, 6 to 8 inches long and have little human faces and crawl. And they are the most terrifying things you have ever seen in your entire life. And of course, they go crazy and they're crawling up the army guy's legs and everybody screaming. It's another traumatizing experience. Thank you, Outer Limits.
Well, it was like, as I say in my afterword too, after that MacGyver episode, my brother and I watched it, and you're trying to sleep at night, and the barest brush of the sheets on your body, it's ants. Everything is ants. The bed is full of ants. The house is full of ants. You know, you just sort of, I remember we couldn't sleep that night because we just felt the entire house was infested with ants, and it took quite a while. And, I know my dad or my mom, you learn as a parent, you're like, I shouldn't let him watch that MacGyver episode. You know, I should have maybe heard some of the early warning signs when they were making noises there in the TV room and gone and shut the darn thing off. But, we have the same thing with my son and YouTube. But by the time the algorithm is, we sort of talked about that last year with the Handyman Method. By the time the algorithm has decided what to show your kids and you're not paying enough attention, it's too late.
You know, one thing that's interesting about insects that you mentioned is that on one hand, they are tiny, and it seems like, such a small thing could not have any intelligence, yet they're social beings. They build, what to them must be skyscrapers. I look at our skyscrapers and I think, those are termite mounds.
Right, yeah. Where we all live stacked on top of each other.
Right. And I think, what's interesting is the idea that as a group, either a hive mind or as led by a queen, that they could, be intelligent. And I think that in itself makes them a good choice to latch your horror novel onto.
Well, you're right. And I think with this one, too, I did, an earlier question of yours was about how much research I did. And I did do some because I just enjoy that aspect of writing, the researching. And I came across this idea called queen mandibular pheromone. Not an idea.
I was going to ask about that. Is that real?
It's real. Yeah.
Oh, and God. So
queens use this as... obviously dissension or personal opinion is not permitted in the insect world, so the queen kind of rules everything, and even she rules in an instinctive kind of way. But in order to sort of keep the hive or the nest functioning, because when a queen is compromised or is dying, the hive will often turn anarchic. It's so important for a functioning colony for there to be these really rigidly stratified sort of roles for everybody. And with this pheromone, she can control her entire hive. She doesn't have to touch them. It is sort of this pulse that she puts out, she exudes from her body, and she can get the drones to do whatever she wants. And it would, I said, for me, it would be like, my son, if it were me, my son's over there at school and I sense that he's acting up. I could just send a pulse out and still him. Or if he had that and, I told him to go to bed, he could make me go walk out and stick my head in a snowbank. So, you know, for the insect world, it's perfectly all right and perfectly normal, but in applied to human beings, that kind of control that you might have over another, you know, living, breathing entity is amoral and terrifying.
Now, this book takes, the themes of teen body horror and revenge, and there's some genetic engineering in there, and mixes them together incredibly well. And one of the things I was just kind of gobsmacked as I read this book, on one hand, it kind of reads like you can just read it like light. It just the pages turn naturally. It's really fun to read.
Glad.
But you're also at as you do as you're reading that, you're realizing, well, these are some pretty interesting themes, with all, between the genetic engineering and the growing up teens. And the when you, as you weave the plot back and forth, it becomes more intense and faster. And I just thought, my God, this, I mean, for a book that is as gooey as this is, and as interested in teenagers as this is, I mean, the writing I thought was really incredible. Talk about just writing on a prose level to keep the pages turning at an incredible rate. I mean, your prose is really, I think, quite beautifully done.
Oh, well, I really appreciate that, Rick. It really does mean a lot hearing that coming from you. I don't know. I've read a lot, well, obviously in the horror sphere and elsewhere, and as to how that developed, and not everyone will feel that way, I imagine, because I
Oh
think
no,
for
they will.
well, I appreciate it.
Trust me, this book is so page turning because we really care about the characters, but you really have achieved that balance between writing about the characters and then just rolling out something that you cannot imagine.
Right. Well, I think that was the real juggling act. I mean, one of several. I mean, another sort of important juggling act, as I do mention in the acknowledgments, and if you want to talk about it, it's my own history and some of the stuff that was happening in my own town that probably bears influence, doesn't probably, definitely bears influence on the book and some of its plot. But in terms of you're right, I think I've always been a like. I really like characters, and I really feel like if I'm not invested, and this is not new, I mean, most writers would say probably something along this line, is that if you don't have some investment in the characters and wanting to follow them on their path, then it'd be going to be hard to get buy-in from the reader as well. But in terms of that, because I'm not really a thriller writer, I mean, I love reading thrillers, and it's not to say that there aren't many, many thrillers that actually do take a lot of care with the characters, because there are. But my general technique is that there's almost, it's not, I guess, kind of a flashback almost. You go back and you find these two characters at a point in the narrative, well, outside of the narrative, in their past, and you sort of flesh out a scene, and then you come back to the main narrative and you continue to go. Now, ideally, with that sense within the reader, of feeling that they know these characters a little bit better, and that sort of progressively you do those types of scenes back and forth, and like to me that's really necessary to again get as you say that sense of feeling that I know the characters, that the readers ideally hopefully feel for the characters as well, and then as you say when you get to these gooey bits, especially the ones where we might lose one of these characters, you know, that there's some kind of resonance to the reader when that, if that were to unfortunately happen, right? So it depends. I think some readers prefer just like barrel on, hell-bent for leather. I can't quite write like that. I just don't have that. It doesn't work for me, I guess. It doesn't work for me on that level. So I'm glad that you found it was really page turning, and I've certainly heard some early feedback that would suggest that as well. So knock on wood. That prevails for most readers.
The other thing that I noticed, and I noticed this in the troupe as well, is that you're an equal opportunity gross out artist. In that, you have your main theme, in a sense, your main horror theme of, you know, genetic manipulation and all sorts of horror in that respect. But also, you're equally adept at capitalizing on somebody's fantasy. And in this fantasy, this character comes to life, but maybe they're dead. And you follow that all the way through, or you seize on emotional. There's a absolutely riveting scene of emotional horror. And to me, I mean, being eaten from the inside out by anything would probably be unpleasant, but the embarrassment that I might experience it were that to happen in front of a crowd when I'm supposed to be composed would be worse. I'd rather just be eaten out by the monster, you know, have the alien come out of my chest, not have it happen at the dinner table.
That's right. It's the added indignity of it being in front of a crowd of your loved ones or people that you care about. Right. I honestly never quite thought about it that way, but I, now that you say it, I completely can see it as being that sort of added, yeah, indignity of, can't I, you know, you like a sick, you just go under a porch somewhere like a sick animal, like just let me do it here where no one is going to see me, rather than, you know, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I am an equal opportunity. And I think, you know, my wife will sometimes hear me cackling up in my writing chambers, and she'll inevitably probably look up and just go, he's doing something disgusting up there. I just know it. And if I could hear, I'd say, yep, I am. Things are going well.
Now, this was set in your hometown. Talk about the influence of your hometown on the events in the novel, because, I mean, that also, I think, probably is what lends it the air of authenticity it has. It feels very real, even as the things that you describe, you think, my God, I mean, they couldn't, there are no special effects yet to do that right.
No. I'd like to hope at some point it might catch up, but you're right, that in terms of my own, I mean, that was a kind of a very, as careful as I could, balancing act. So the main thing between these two characters, Margaret and Charity, there wasn't my hometown back when I was in, you know, 1994, 95, when I was the age that these characters are, God, you know, so 30 years ago, there was a serial killer in our hometown. And he, you know, we go visit my mom and dad, you know, who still live there, as I said, you know, every month or often more than that. And if you walk out, they live in this very quaint lakefront kind of community. And if you walk out to the end of my parents' driveway and look south, you will see the house that this guy lived in. It's no longer that house. It's been torn down and a new one has been built. But that's how close he was. And he was lurking in this really quiet, bucolic kind of, again, quiet community. And I remember I was, the rowing regatta is not far from there. And I was a very poor rower in high school, but I did row. And the police came one day down to practice and asked us all to drop our oars and go look through this wilderness area over to the side. And we didn't realize it at the time, but we were looking for the bodies of one of the two girls that this guy ended up murdering. And I remember, obviously we all remember that galvanized the entire community. It shook us. And anyone who lived there at that time or just lives in the city knows about that guy and the two women. But the way I remembered it, Rick, and this, again, memory, as you know, at our age, like, memory's weird. You know what I mean? It's not particularly as reliable as you'd like to think it is. But I had this distinct memory that of the two, one of the two girls was quite well off and came from a distinguished, wealthy family. And the other girl came from less, more modest means, maybe even from a, you know, blue collar working class family. And that because of that class distinction, they were memorialized differently. That the rich girl was seen as this great loss, whereas the poor girl was seen as, no, it was important, but maybe not as important, you know, like it just, she wasn't spoken about as much. Nobody had a story about her, whereas everybody seemed to have a story about the rich girl. There is a trail in our city commemorating one of them, and there's not a trail commemorating the other one. So, I mean, that just stuck with me, the sort of unfairness of it, I think, and the strangeness of it, that like these are both 17, 18 year old girls. They both had their entire futures and lives ahead of them. They both had the equal amount of promise, because at that age, you're all promise, right? You're all hope and you're all potential. So why would there be any difference? But that very much fed into the writing of this book and the way that, as you know, having read it, the kind of plot takes place in that sort of class disparity, in a sense that like when someone goes missing, there's a big outpouring about it and a lot of effort. And then when another type of person goes missing, it seems as though there's not as many efforts taken to sort of like find that person again. So that was a big part of the writing, but obviously recognizing that it is based on fact, and there are, you know, there are families who still remain, and I wanted to make sure that I made it understood that it was my recollection of events, which is not necessarily a factual recollection of events, that spurred the writing of it. So again, in the afterwards, I make sure to clarify that as best I can, but it's a tricky thing. And I know you've spoken to hundreds of writers over the course of your career, and we do often pick from things that actually happen to us. But I do think there is definitely a moral responsibility, as best we can, if we're going to write about those things, to write about them with as responsibly as we can, while still actually writing about them if we so choose.
You know, many years ago, I had read a book by T.C. Boyle about identity theft. And then I read a book by Jeff Vandermeer that was set in this fantasy kingdom. And what struck me about both those books, although they were very different, and a number of other books I'd seen at the time and have seen since, was that the economy plays a big role. And it struck me at that point in time that we might be headed towards a time, it has not happened yet, but I wait for when there'll be a genre of fiction, or that fiction will necessarily organize itself into a genre of fiction that is about the import of the economy and that economics plays in our lives. And I thought you handled that really beautifully in this book. In terms of, you know, the trailer park people versus the, you know, the people who lived in the suburbs, and, you know, the person who had gone from one world to the other, I thought that was really well handled, and also played well into the superstructure of the book, as you explained. So talk about, you know, and I've seen this before too in your books, you know, the import of using people's economic status to help define character, and the import of economics in the overall book plot.
That's a great way to sum it up, better than I will, I'm sure, but because it is important. I think it was Stephen King, who obviously is a massive influence of mine, who said something like, a lot of horror stories are economic, you know, why do you move to the haunted house? It's because you can't get a house elsewhere. Do you know what I mean? Like there's a lot of, in horror, people are driven, I think, by circumstantial economic misfortunes or disparities into the sort of plot, you know, mechanics that will unfurl off of that. So, and I, you know, my father was a banker and did well for himself, and we were always middle class. And probably towards the end of his career would be considered upper middle class in our, so we were not at the level of some of the people in this book that I described, because they're, you know, in St. Catharines or anywhere, there are all sorts of different sort of gradations of wealth, but we were, you know, there was never any worry about food on the table or clothes on our backs or anything. But I went to a school that bordered sort of one of the more impoverished areas in our city, and I became friends with, you know, lots of friends of different like social class, and I would feel guilty, frankly, for I think some of the things that I had, you know, and, you know, you'd go over to someone's house and it would be powdered milk. And, you know, you'd go for a sleepover and you'd have a lovely time, but you would just notice, like, they'd open the cupboard and there'd be a lot more like no name brands than at your own house. And so you felt like, and yet these were loving, strong households that they came from. And frankly, in some of the rich households, you'd see, you know, really cavalier parenting or, you know, so, I mean, it's not like there's any sort of sense of like class having a definite impact on your upbringing for sure. But I just remember sort of like that feeling. And I thought, you know, again, because we were always middle class, it's not like there was ever this sort of like yo-yo of wealth where we went from here to here. But I thought, yeah, I bet you someone who went from more modest means to like incredibly high means and had, you know, had friends, you know, that they would feel maybe uncomfortable with that sort of disparity that suddenly had, and it would feel in the same way, like moving away. So these two characters, you know, before Margaret moves away, she'd already kind of parted from her best friend Charity because she'd moved out of the trailer park where they had grown up their entire lives. And because her father had, you know, had created this invention that had given them riches beyond anything they ever would have imagined. So it was sort of a double pronged separation. First on a class level, and then because she was going to actually leave town. And that, you know, again, going back to the human part of it, it's painful. You know, I had such great, because again, when I left, went away to university, that was simply because my parents could afford to send me away. And there were lots of people who stayed who were just as intelligent and just as ambitious as I was, who didn't have that opportunity to do so because the finances in order to sort of fund that were not available to them. And when you're a kid, you don't necessarily see that disparity, or you don't want to, but certainly as an adult and as a, you know, as a writer, I do.
The new novel by Nick Cutter is The Queen. Let me tell you that it is an absolute page-turning nightmare of imagination that will probably have one say, seek therapy. But it's also a wonderfully nuanced look at characters covered in slime.
That's brilliant. I wish I could use that for a blurb. I wish we hadn't everything wasn't set already to the printer, because I would borrow that if I could, Rick.
Thank you for joining me, Craig.
Thank you very much, Rick. As always, my pleasure.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.